Academic books on foreign policy can be a bit daunting for the general reader, even for students. Australian foreign policy analysts rarely buck the party line, and it doesn't matter much which party they belong to. Clifton Fernandez's Island off the Coast of Asia is slightly different. Its rather unassuming subtitle, Instruments of Statecraft in Australian Foreign Policy, might suggest that it's a traditional foreign policy tome. Not so. For example, over the weekend, The Guardian highlighted one of the historical revelations from the book, that many of Australia's leading colonial statesmen were deeply mired in the business of slavery and, in fact, used the profits from selling those slaves after abolition to make their settlements here. The slavery issue and other colonial matters are significant because they show how economic factors play such a critical role in the formation of a country's foreign policy. Clifton Fernandez, former Australian Army officer, served in the Intelligence Corps, and today he is Professor of International Studies at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. And Clinton joins us from our Canberra studio. Welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Clinton, why the title, An Island off the Coast of Asia?
Oh, well, it was based on the geopolitical tradition to which we belong, namely the European one. Britain saw itself, its tradition, as an island off the coast of Europe, which is a geopolitical statement as much as a geographical one. It wanted to ensure that no single power would dominate the European continent. The United States tried something similar in 1950. One of the key post-war planners, George F. Kennan, said that the United States has to see itself as an island off the coast of Eurasia. And so for Australia, I think it's just part of the same tradition, which is we have to do the best we can to influence events in the continental area while staying a part of it.
Clinton, emphatically, security for you is not just about the fear of invasion.
No, that's right. I think security has a very expansive meaning. It prioritizes economic interests. Then there is a military and political order that has to be constructed to defend those interests. This is not simply a personal view. I've actually been able to look at the entirety of the archival system for many years, obviously not things that are not in the open area, in the open period. And that is the most distinctive aspect of our external relations. Security is what dominant groups think they have, ought to have, and then try and get military and political force in order to achieve those aims.
And yet the punters see invasion as up first and foremost, and perhaps, you know, first, second, and third.
Yes, that's true. Look, the fears are genuinely held where they are held, by the public. And let's take the post-war world. The security fears were genuinely held. You know, there was fear of communism, fear of the domino theory, fear of the Malaysian Communist Party, the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. These fears, I'm not saying they were not genuinely held, but they conform with great precision to the roles that various actors have to play in a benign environment for our economic interests. So, for example, when there was an actual threat to Australia in the Second World War, the government built the fourth largest air force in the world, and we had an army with a peak strength of almost 500,000. But then, despite all the fears about communism in Southeast Asia in the 50s and 60s, the army size never rose above 30,000.
But that was also the consideration. There was a new way to kill each other, wasn't there, with the A-bomb, much cheaper than boots on the ground.
Yeah, total war was a possibility, but we're talking about basically a counterinsurgency campaign in Malaya, a counterinsurgency campaign in Vietnam. And in that case, there was no possibility. In fact, the internal declassified records show that the intelligence agencies had no concerns whatsoever about a penetrating threat, a thrust down into Australia itself.
At this little wireless program, we're well aware of the role of Indian investment in Australian politics. Mm-hmm. But as you point out, the early Australian colony wouldn't have survived without the Indian connection. This, I think, is quite a fascinating case of economics dominating...
Oh, absolutely. Look, the fact is that the colonies that were established would have failed had it not been for grain, foodstuffs, live animals for protein, spirits, clothing, everything came in from Bengal. And that today is Bangladesh. But, we derive a certain geostrategic tradition from that. British actions at the time were designed to create zamindars, landlords, a landowning class who would be, compliant local elites with imperial power. And Britain succeeded in doing that. And our tradition since then has derived from it. Okay, it is, we wanted a group of elites in Malaya, and now Malaysia, Vietnam, and of course Indonesia, General Suharto, who were willing to align their economic policies with what we wanted. And so that was the basis of security. And yes, it does derive from even before the colonies were fully established in this country.
Well, I hadn't realized that by 1840, a ship traveled between India and Australia about every 4.5 days, and they were a lifeline for the new settlement.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm relying on other historians, of course, like David Walker and so on. These are people who've studied that period in great detail. But yes, the imperial connection was to Bengal, to India. It was the Royal Navy, the British Navy, that secured that connection. In fact, one of the points that I've said in the book is that, that the Battle of Trafalgar, 1805, is one of the most important battles in the history of Australia, and it didn't even involve any Australian forces.
Well, I'm glad you've raised that, because some of the timber in the Speaker's chair in the Australian House of Reps from 27 to 88 from Nelson's flagship.
Yeah, it's still there. I mean, when I go across, now the archives has moved into the reading room anyway, has moved into the Provisional Parliament House. And so I get a chance to see that all the time. And yes, the Speaker's chair in the House of Reps comes straight from Lord Nelson's victory, HMS Victory. And there is a statement by the then acting Prime Minister, Earl Page, who ultimately preceded Menzies, noting the significance of that ship and the chair, saying that this words to the effect of, the sight of this oak will remind us of the greatness of Trafalgar. Here I'm paraphrasing, but that's broadly what he said.
I mentioned the slavery issue in introducing it. Mm-hmm. Not a mention of the blackbirding episode with Pacific Islanders later in the 19th century.
Yes.
We're talking about the Australian connection to Caribbean slavery.
Yes. The British Caribbean was, of course, the site of immense wealth as a result of slavery and the production of sugar. Now, there was a crisis of overproduction after around 1790, 1791. And after that, say in the early 1800s, the sugar merchants, the planters, were coming to the British Parliament cap in hand, begging for relief. One of the things that happened was the banning of the transportation of slaves between Africa and the Caribbean, but not slavery itself. Now, that was eventually abolished in 1834. And when that was abolished, the government of Britain paid £20 million in compensation to the slave owners because they'd been expropriated off their property, namely the slaves. In today's terms, that's about £300 billion, because that's 40% of the British national income. And several prominent people were compensated. They filed claims for compensation. And those claims for compensation benefited them when they made investments in Australia and set up lives and so on.
Why haven't I heard of this before? I understand you got into the archives at University College London and you dug stuff out there.
Well, I mean, there is a database that's available now online, and I first began not with the UCL database. I just began by trying to verify or falsify a hypothesis about the involvement of slavery. Look, there is something that, has to be said, and it doesn't give me any great pleasure to sort of go after, colleagues in the profession, but the fact is that for many years, the Australian Dictionary of Biography has remained silent on the question of slavery. I understand it's under revision, and there is a new group of people in there that are trying to fix it. But in time after time, what we see is the ADB, the Dictionary of Biography, name a person, a prominent person, as born in the Bahamas, or son of a planter, or was a plantation owner.
But that doesn't tease the significance of that.
Right, but they don't say, they refrain from saying what kind of plantation it was. It was a slave plantation. And so they talk, it is beggars belief that the original authors, the people who were writing in the 60s, didn't know that. They had to have known, because slavery, they were experts in the 19th century, these historians writing in the 60s and 70s. And so they, of course, they would have known that slavery was a respectable form of investment. People who were vicars, military officers, leaders of small towns, founders of the elite royal yacht squadron, banking institutions, people who were in there, they had investments in these Jamaicans, as a British Caribbean, Barbados, Bahamas, and so on. Plantations. That was an investment. People who had these investments were not shunned. And it was a normal form of how you made your money. And so they had to have known, these historians of the 60s and 70s, what kind of plantations we're talking about. The guy who first pioneered the growing of sugar in Australia, John Buchholz, the Dictionary of Biography says about him that he was a planter or a son of a planter, and he pioneered the growth of the growing of sugar in this country. Well, what kind of plantation did he actually learn to grow sugar on, if not slave plantations?
So much to cover, so little time. Let us jump briefly to John Curtin's speech during World War II, which shifted our gaze towards Washington, mm-hmm. away from London. That still influences our foreign policy, of course.
Oh, yes. The idea is, what I think is the defining trend of our foreign policy, is our history, is that we began our existence as part of a very powerful empire, which was on the winning side of the global confrontation between, say, Europe and the rest of the world. And for us, the organizing principle of our foreign relations is to remain on that winning side. And so when it looked pretty clear that the emerging power after the Second World War would be the United States, we made overtures towards them. What's not often mentioned, of course, is that these initial overtures were rejected. Douglas MacArthur, when he met Curtin in June 42, said, you're part of the British Empire, and we see you only as a base from which to hit Japan. It doesn't matter the fact that our peoples might have a warm friendship for you, but we'd be carrying on this policy of military action regardless of who might be occupying Australia at any given time. And so for them, we are a suitable piece of real estate, as a famous phrase is.
Any chance of Australia ever having a truly independent foreign policy?
I think for that you'd need to alter the domestic structure of power, in terms of the economic interests. But no, I think that this geostrategic reflex is very strong. It is to be part of a bigger power, and this is something that even the Chinese have said. There is a quite a famous line in which a former senior a People's Liberation Army officer has said that, you know, quote, Australia has to find a godfather sooner or later. Australia always has to depend on someone else, whether it's to be the son of the US or son of China. It depends on who is more powerful and based on the strategic environment, unquote. But it's not appeasement. I mean, we are not kind of appeasing the US or being, you know, doing things out of subservience. It is a rational decision taken on the basis that the world operates on an amoral basis. It operates on the basis of power, and the United States is the most powerful country, and we are fortunate in that sense, so the argument goes, to be on the side of the US.
We've got to wind it up, Clinton, on that happy note. Clinton Fernandez, Professor of International Studies at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. Very interesting stuff in his new book, Ireland Off the Coast of Asia, Instruments of Statecraft in Australian Foreign Policy. It's now available from Monash University Publishing.